Accession number 32369, reel 5.
Mr. Cassidy, reel 5. What was your wage in those early days?
Well, our wage was under continual reconstruction. When we first did training, we were on a very small weekly sum of well less than £10 a week, and that was split into different categories of, funnily enough, we still paid tax. We were advised and said that we should put a bit away for a bit of savings each week. There was a little piece to send home if we needed it, to send to parents. Now and again there was off-takes for what they termed as barrack room damage. If any damage had been done to the barrack rooms or anything, then it was paid by everybody, not just one individual who'd caused the damage, so that was on as well. But with the training that we're on, we didn't really spend a great deal of money, i.e. We were restricted to going out in the town until after the first 6 or 8 weeks of training. So I would say that the money was spent on cleaning materials for boot polish and brasso and incendiaries for sweets and chocolates and things like that that we would keep. And then because our meals were obviously provided to us free gratis, so that was one thing we didn't have to pay for. But there was always the town where, when we did manage to get out, where the local bars were always welcome to take the money off you, and the coffee shops in them days there, the 60s, were just starting, and the coffee shops and the jukeboxes were just coming into their really peak then, you know, and pop groups were coming on the scene. So it was the start of the 60s, start of a new era, and music was then becoming a big culture in young people's lives, and especially in our lives, all, you know, 17 and 18 year olds, it was a part of our life. So we wanted to be part of it as well as being training to be a professional soldier as well, and we combined the two. But the days went by very, very quickly, and everything was new. The training was rigorous. The programme was very tight, and we were doing a few exercises outside where a lot of us hadn't even been really camped out other than under our own roof at home. So it was all completely new to us, and we really bonded together as a unit then in training.
What about church parades? Were they there from the very beginning?
Yeah, we had a padre who came, was coming from a Catholic family, of course. The Catholic padre who came to see us, of the cadre that we were in, there was probably about 3 or 4 Catholics. So we were had our own separate little group. He would... very much an army chaplain, really. He'd been involved in the Second World War, so he had a lot of experience, and he knew the rigours of training and young people and how they went on. And he more or less just reminded us of our Catholic religion and our contributions that we should make to the church and things like that. And he always left a big saying in our minds when he left, that one day when we were in trouble, that the first thing we should turn to is our faith. And he says, you may not feel it now, but he says you certainly will do, if not in your training, certainly through one part of the army, your career, you will turn to your faith again and wish that God was by your side for to help you out, he said. And this always stuck in my mind anyway, and he always kept it there. It was difficult to keep our Sunday contributions, i.e. to go to church every Sunday. Sometimes we were on duties, and sometimes we were on exercise. So it was very easy to fall into a mode of forgetfulness of what Sundays were really all about. And it was, you know, later in life when we actually went to the battalions, where they had chaplains within the battalion, and also on the camps they had their own churches as well. So it was only then that we really got back into the swing of things as though we were at home again. But we still realised our Catholic religion and upbringing, and it was always stood us in good faith for the half dozen of us that were in the Ocada who were Catholics. And as I say, we did have Sunday morning parades where there were church parades, and you were told you to be on parade at a certain time, and you were you know, from there you were whisked away to have mass, and came back to your barracks afterwards as well. But few and far between, because obviously the army duties always came first before religion as well. But at the same time, they did remind us of our religion, and there was time where, you know, at any time during the day, if we wanted to see the Catholic padre or anything like that, he was available on call, and we could go and see him if we had any problems. And we were okay that way with him. So.
And then, presumably after church parade, the rest of the day was your own time on a Sunday?
Normally on a Sunday, yeah, it was your own time. And it was mainly Mondays were always big days for either the start of drill week or something like that. So Sundays would be leisure time at that stage in training, would be getting your kit ready, bulling your boots, cleaning your brassos, ironing your shirts, and BDs and things like that, you know, general barrack room things. Naffy, we would probably go to the Naffy sometime during the day for a cup of coffee and a chat and things like that. And after the first half of our training, then of course we would be allowed into the town. And as long as we were dressed smartly, and we were always taught on how to dress properly, and we had a routine of really you were inspected before you left the barracks to make sure you were properly dressed before you went into the town. And that involved things like, although you weren't expected to wear a shirt and ties or anything like that, you had to be smartly dressed, and your shoes had to be cleaned, and things like that. So, you know, it wasn't just a case of strolling out in tracksuits or anything like that. You couldn't do that. You had to be smartly dressed before you were allowed out through the gatehouse. And you went through a bit of a routine of a mirror, standing in front of the mirror, having a good look at yourself, and then reporting to the guardhouse and signing yourself out, who you were again, name, rank and number, and that was it. And you had to be back in by a certain time as well. I think it was probably before midnight anyway when we were in training, so let me make sure we were back in reasonable order by that time for to get back to the barracks.
At what point in your training did you fire your weapons for the first time on the ranges?
It was very early on, really. I would think it was after about the first 6 weeks, and we'd only had the SLRs then for a week to get used to it, and found out how heavy they seemed, and how we stripped them down, and how we put them together, how we cleaned them. And like I said before, we had to do it blindfold. And then we were given a couple of lectures first on the do's and don'ts of what happens firing live ammunition. And as I said, we were bussed up to a place at Strensel and put on the live firing range, where it was an all-day affair of firing at different positions and different targets, and learning how to hold and breathe properly when firing the SLR. And we all, I know, came back after the first week of firing with bruised shoulders because of the kickback of this weapon, which was very, very accurate at the time. I think the weapon before that was what the one that had been using in the Second World War, the 303, and things like that. So this was a completely brand new, sophisticated weapon that we're using, and it was very accurate when it was zeroed in properly. And we, of course, we had to learn how to zero the rifle. And
how did you do that? What was the
well with a series of shots? We would fire at the target, and then we would be told how low or how high or to the left or to the right the rounds were going, and then by a series of adjustments to the sight, we would adjust the sights to suit ourselves. Obviously, if the rounds were firing off to the left, we would zero them in to bring them to the right, and they would stop like that, because obviously the weapon stopped with us all through training. And that's how we, you know, we expected them to be very, very accurate each time we went on the range.
And to move the sight, was it some kind of little?
Yeah, we had a little tool that I mean, we didn't used to carry it, but the armourer or one of the NCOs who were with us always had one in his pocket, and he would come along and say, "Well, you're firing low. I would lift your sights by 25." Degrees, and then try that and see how that goes at different ranges. You know, we would first of all 50, 100, 200, 300, 400, up to 700 yards, you know, and that was a long way, you know, but it was such an accurate weapon, it was unbelievable. The only fallback we had with it was the kickback that it had until you got used to it in your shoulder. But other than that, and of course, the rounds that it fired, the 7.62, was a really destructive round as well. We were shown the damage it did to different objects and things like that. And although it wasn't armoured piercing, it was, to hit somebody, which left a small hole, but it did a lot of damage when it was passing through anybody's body, so...
Was it an automatic weapon or semi-automatic?
It was automatic, and the magazine at that time would hold, I think it was about 20 rounds at one time, so it was really, you know, a really good weapon. And of course we had to learn we did our arms drills with it as well, and at that time we used to, when we were on the march, we would carry it at the shoulder. And in later times it was changed to carrying it at the trail, but when we were doing the drill then, it was all done carrying it at the shoulder.
And were you introduced to any other weapons whilst in training?
Oh, we were shown the 2-inch mortar with a variflame, obviously the small rounds, using that mainly for variflames during exercise to light up the sky and things like that. But they did have high explosive rounds as well that went in the tube, but mainly they were used for lighting up the sky and things like that. We were shown the rocket launcher, which at that time was one of the older type ones, and it had been in service for quite some time, but at the same time it was we were not allowed, because of the at that time the amount of cost it was to fire a live round from the rocket launcher, we weren't given the chance to fire any live ones, so it was all done with dummy rounds and that. And mainly those were of course we got a chance to fire the officer's pistol at that time as well. although none of us carried a one, we all wanted to see what we could do with the pistol with a live round, and we were given the chance at Strentel as well to do that. But all the weapons we were always being shown faction figures and films on the different weapons that we would come across when we joined the battalion, and what was going on in the army in all the forces at that time of the day, you know, with all the different weapons. So it was good, you know, really to be introducing them. And of course, as we progressed in our training, and the training became more sophisticated, we were introduced to things like helicopters and how to, you know, how we'll move from one place to another in a helicopter. And I mean, most of us had never been in an aeroplane at that time, never mind a helicopter or anything. So it was all brand new. And
you didn't do any actual flights in training, did you?
Oh no, no. We did have a day out at one of the RAF places, and we were practicing the loading and unloading of a dummy helicopter. It never actually left the ground, but we imagined that it did, and we had to get into positions of loading and how we would sit when we got in the helicopter, and when it was landed, how we would get off quick and take up firing positions and things like that. But it never actually left the ground, so it was all a bit make-believe in a way. But it was very good. It was a good insight in the training itself.
Route marches. Did you have to do any route marches?
Training was of the paramount. We always had a couple of people who were with the PTIs who said, well, you know, if you keep up training, you'll be a good athlete, you know, and all that. But of course, some of them who were in the training with us had been athletes as well, and they would be up at the crack of dawn out and go for a 5 mile run on their own, you know, nothing to do with the training, it was just that they got used to doing that sort of thing. But the route marches were first of all started off at a very steady light pack route march, and gradually built up to where we were going out in full marching order with rifles and with our kits on our backs and steel helmets, and really put through the mill over marsh and mallow around about Pontefract and places like that. And after about the first one or two, then the blisters, if you'd had blisters, you were getting blisters on top of each blister as well, so there gradually your feet got adjusted to that, and got through it. It was hard, but I must admit that it got easier as well in a way, because once you'd done it once, then you knew that you it was well within your scope to do it at any time, and from then you were given a goal to say, well, you did that in an hour and a half, next time we'll try and do it in an hour, and the same part. So it was a goal to aim for, and it was all aimed for the end of our training, when it would be a stamina test. And it was something that we had to aim for and achieve, otherwise we would be given the dreaded word of back squatted, where we wouldn't be allowed to pass out, and we would have to do our training all over again. So we made sure, well, most of us did anyway, that we were fit enough to do the rigours of the train itself. But of course there was we did get some injuries as well, and a lot of them were dealt with by the medical room quite easy, with grazes and blisters and things like that. And we were introduced to the old excuses of sick period. So obviously, I mean, if you some mornings you woke up and you didn't feel like doing the rigours of the day, so it would come into the idea of saying, well, I think I'll go sick today. There's something I don't want to do. But of course, there was genuine cases as well, you know, with young people, and we were learnt the rigours of sick parade meant that you had to be up at the crack of dawn. In some cases, you had to pack all your bedding up and hand it in to the quartermaster. You would have to pack all your kit up, and you would go on sick parade with your suitcase and kit bag packed as though you were going away on holiday or something like that. And that was just for sick parade. I think in one way it was a deterrent to stop you going sick, and it did work in a way, because nobody could be bothered to do it all that every day. The other thing was, if you were genuine sick and you ended up in hospital, then at least all your kit was with you, your personal kit and everything, and your bed was handed in for somebody else to take it over. So sick parade was one of these things.
So that in effect meant that if you were sick but not sick enough to go to hospital, you'd have to go back and get all your gear. When you came back,
it would be the routine of drawing your kit, your bedding back out again, making your bed and getting your kit back and putting it all back into your locker again. So that was sick parade.
Was there any form of kind of a magic pill given for all ailments?
No, you were actually not really. I think the recommendations then was just to look after yourself. We were given a few lectures by the medical officer on personal hygiene and things like that. But it was mainly on the use of cleanliness for your feet, how important it was to look after your feet, and every now and again there was a dental check, and general cleanliness, really. There was no magic pills or anything like that to say, Lucozade is good for you or anything like that. It was just, when you're going on these route marches, drink as much water as you can, but make sure you have your breakfast every morning, regardless of how you feel. You must have a breakfast in the morning.
Did you get the lectures on VD then?
Yes, we got all that. There were, of course, a lot of it was new to a lot of us as well, although it had been touched on in our school and things like that. Nothing at all as much as what they go into today, but it was, a lot of it was new to us. And of course, being the Army Kinema photography went into vivid detail of everything when we were getting these lectures. So it was quite, I would say, horrific at some of the things that they showed us, and I think it must have put a few of us off for a long time after that.
What about the equipment that went missing or stolen?
Well, we were always aware when we went out to the barracks that there was things left around, and if we'd been on exercise or come back and then somebody had said, well, I've lost to this or something's gone missing. I must admit, we were in a very lucky, and it only happened once or twice, I think, and I don't think we ever found out where it had gone. Somebody, a lad lost an amount of money one night, and there was a big inquiry on where it could have gone from and who could have taken it, and there was a lot of accusing fingers and things like that, but We were pretty lucky. I mean, the main thing was that the last one out always locked the barrack door with us being together, and there wasn't anything really that went amiss.
And missing stuff for them, you'd have to replace it yourself, would you, from the quartermaster stores?
If we lost some of our equipment, yes, we would. We were told not to hide anything at all and go. Even if it was just the brass button stick or anything like that that we use for cleaning our buttons and collar badges, just to make sure we report them missing, and they would be replaced and the money would be taken out of your pay. So it was nice to keep it like that. We didn't lose very much, you know that.
What memories have you got of your officers that you were meeting at this time? Good, bad, or indifferent?
Yeah, the officers I think that we had were regular officers who had either been straight from Sandhurst, and before they joined their battalion had come to Morris try out the skills what they'd learned there on us, and also officers who had been injured or had been in hospital for a while and were convalescent or coming back to regular fitness, and were sent to the depot or the training depot before they actually joined their units and things like that. But off and on, I mean, we didn't see many officers. We had a platoon officer and obviously a commanding officer. And
do you remember any of the names?
No, the only one I can remember is an officer who I came into contact with, and who was DLI, and it was a Captain Mike Sumner, they called him. I never forget him. He was he'd broken his leg in a parachute fall in the UK, and he'd been hospitalised for a while, and he'd come to the depot just to get himself fit again, really, before he joined the battalion. And he was a proper gentleman's officer, and as much as he was one of the lads as well, he thought nothing of on a night time coming round to the barrack room and sitting down and having a talk with the lads and telling, you know, saying about, asking them about their experiences and telling us about his experiences. And he was he had some great tales to tell us as well. I mean, he was a one of these officers who had come through the ranks, and he'd he was a racing driver, he was learning to be a pilot, he was airborne, and everything, he had done it. And yet, probably he was only in his late 20s then, you know, and he was a captain. So we were always awed with him when Mike Sumner came, you know, and he was a guy that said, well, if ever I was in trouble, if there's one officer I would like to be with, it would be him. And he put his hand to anything, you know. He was a good shot on the range, and whatever he did, fitness, he was always fit and out running, and he had a little sports car, and he was just one of these officers that we had always dreamt about would exist. And later in life, obviously when I joined the battalion, he was one of the first officers who I saw, I seeked out and got back on a good relationship with him in Berlin. But he was great.
What about the instructors? Do you recall any of those?
Not by name, but I know there was three or four of them corporals who they were pretty good. There was always being told that what the risks were for bullying and all that, but obviously at the same time they had to install the discipline into the training as well. So I wouldn't say we disliked them in any way. They all seemed to be, everything they did was shouting, and we got used to it after a time. So they weren't too bad, really.
What about the language then? Did you get used to the language, or was it a bit of a shock in the beginning?
One or two, with the language, it was a bit over the top, and a couple of the instructors would use it. Every other word would be a swear word and things like that. But on the main, I think it wasn't really too bad, you know, except a lot of it, the language came out when something happened or went wrong, really, more than using it as a general part of the language itself.